UK Wine Show, show number 191 for the 22nd of January 2009. Peter Franz and Sensible Wine Service. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we have another cracking show. We talk with Peter Franz from one of the UK's most successful wine companies, Sensible Wine Services. They don't sell wine, but they're the oil that lubricates the wine industry events. In the spotlight, we're finishing off looking at blending wine, as well as the news and our usual mystery region. This week for me has been quite frustrating. I've done lots of work, but no real progress on anything. But went to the Bibendum trade tasting, and didn't taste as many wines as I normally would, but I managed to get some cracking interviews. I spent quite a bit of time talking to Tim Hannay. He's a master of wine and a chef, and I've got three podcasts with him that have completely shattered my understanding of food and wine matching. It's going to take some time to digest, and I think I might get a bit of indigestion as I go through the shows, but they're going to be out in February, and they're quite a radically different way of looking at wine and food matching. I must apologise to the listener who came up to me and wanted to look at the Winescriber app. I was just about to go and do an interview with Ryan Opaz, so I couldn't actually show him the app, and then I couldn't find him later on, so I apologise for that. But let's not worry about that too much. Let's get into this week's show. And first up, we've got our mystery wine region. As usual, I'm going to give you two clues, one now, one later on, and the answer at the end. So, our mystery wine region is located in New Zealand, with soils that are a result of 200 million years when glaciers carved out mountains and deposited stony soils along the Wairau River. Silty and sand loam now cover the base, creating free-drained soils which are perfect for grape growing. Sunny, but not excessive heat, gives the grapes a long, slow ripening period, and the region's average daytime temperature of 24 degrees Celsius and a nighttime difference of at least 10 degrees Celsius helps keep the acidity in the grapes. This gives a freshness to the wines that they're known for. Ponder that, and I'm going to give you the next clue, which is a pretty big one, after the news, coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. A new low-alcohol wine called Vetro will be one of the first to clearly display the units of alcohol on its front label in response to the government's Know Your Limits campaign. UK wine importer Bottle Green is launching their low-alcohol wine in collaboration with Italian producer Medici Emet. The wine is a 4% ABV Lambrusco, containing 3 units of alcohol per 75 centilitres. The news coincides with the Conservative Party unveiling plans to scrap the current unit system for measuring alcohol consumption if they're elected. Vetro will be launched at the London Wine Fair in May with a red, a white and a rosé.
Because Vetro's from Italy, they've got an unfair advantage in that in the EU, there's only a couple of regions in Italy and Germany, they're allowed to call these wines wine. Everyone else has to call it partially fermented grape juice. Catchy title. Some people say that the conservative approach to knowing your alcohol level is too complicated. Now, to me, it's so much simpler. What they want to do is just give you the total amount of alcohol in a bottle, say 9 centilitres. It's pretty easy to work out. You take the millilitres and you multiply it by the ABV, which is so much easier than taking millilitres, timing it by an ABV, and then having to look up some sort of units to map them. I heard the BBC Breakfast Show talk to some people on the street about it, and they said it was far too hard. Well, if you can't do basic maths, then you're not old enough to drink, or you've had too much to drink. And it's even easier because your average bottle is 750 mils, which means all you need to do is take 3/4 of the ABV, and hey presto, there you've got it in centilitres. So for example, 12% wine, 3/4 of 12% is 9, that's 9 centilitres of pure alcohol. How simple can that get? If that's too hard for some people, they shouldn't be drinking. On the bright side, I had a nice Esti last night, 7.5%. But afterwards, Jane did make the comment, the best part of wine is the alcohol. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, it's been confirmed that most of the 88 franchise stores licensed by First Quench Retailing will continue to trade as independent off-licences. A law firm is finalising a deal with administrators KPMG to reach a settlement over money owed to First Quench by the franchisees and to agree the leases of the shops with property agent Christie's. It's likely that KPMG will give franchisees credits for the unused proportion of their franchise fees, which were paid up front to First Quench.
Like a phoenix rising from the ashes, 88 new independents. It's the first big step up for the independent wine industry in the UK for ages. Let's hope that they don't stock the same range as the now defunct Threshers. The story is changing from a saga to fresh buds. It's all part of the business process. What's the last story about the business process, Jane?
Well, specialist drinks shipper ABV Logistics has been acquired by JF Hillebrand in order to strengthen Hillebrand's global wine and beverage logistics services, particularly in Italy and Iberia, where ABV are already strong. The two businesses will continue to operate as normal, but eventually the ABV team will relocate to Hillebrand UK's West Thurrock offices. ABV directors Gary Gordon and Daniel Morris will join the board of JF Hillebrand UK. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website for these stories at 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Hillebrand is a major logistic company in the UK and the world, and the purchase is supposed to improve Hillebrand in Iberia. But most mergers and acquisitions destroy value. Just listen to Warren Buffett, investor extraordinaire and significant shareholder in Kraft, squeal about Kraft buying Cadbury's this week. M&As are not good. They're good for CEOs' egos. Hillebrand specializes in moving wines from winery to purchaser in bulk. But this week we're talking to another logistics company, Sensible Wine Service, which are much more focused on the UK wine scene and the event industry within the UK wine scene. We're going to be talking with Peter Franz from Sensible after this week's Spotlight, which is going to be finishing up looking at blending. So let's have our spotlight. One important element of blending is not so much to improve the quality, but to improve the finances through insurance. Well, insurance varieties, that is. Because different grape varieties go through their life cycle at different speeds, having a range of varieties in your vineyard provides some protection against the weather. The key weather patterns are frost, wind, and rain. A late frost can wipe out many early budding varieties. Here, the frost destroys the tender buds. Varieties that burst forth at a later time will not succumb to the damage and have their tender buds burnt off. This can mean the difference between having a crop and not having a drop to sell. As a result, some wineries have varieties in their vineyard that they blend together so that they can get a crop consistently from year to year. Bordeaux is a classic example. The next big risk is flowering. Some varieties do not flower and fertilize well in windy conditions, while others do. Different varieties can give better results with flowering and protect the vineyard from losing their crop. Finally, rain can create problems. Wet conditions can cause the outbreak of molds and mildew in the vine, with some, such as Pinot Noir, very susceptible, while others, such as Cabernet Sauvignon, less so. While all grapes don't like their roots getting wet, different rootstocks are better adapted to sodden soils. As a result, vineyards use a range of rootstocks to manage the rain and vigour in their vineyards. Different rootstocks is not the only vine difference. A vineyard can be planted with, say, Chardonnay, and they may not be all the same. Within Chardonnay, there are a variety of clones, and each clone has its own characteristics, flavours, and lifestyle. So you can blend a range of different styles of Chardonnay from the same vineyard because they're grown from different clones. Often when planting a vineyard, they may have a range of rootstocks and clones to meet different soil and climate conditions within the vineyard. Often these different clones are harvested separately and then blended, each providing their own personality to the final blend. Okay, that finishes up our look at blending. If you want to reread the whole article in its fullest, you can get it from our website, 3050.co.uk, and click on podcast, and on the left-hand side, you'll see the section called winemaking, and it's in there. While you do that, have a good look around our site. And remember that 3050 effectively sponsor the UK Wine Show. So if you know anybody who's looking for a wine tasting, whether it be a corporate or private event, do get them to give us a call and give them our website, 3050.co.uk. Right now, from blending grapes to our mystery wine region, where most of the wines are a single variety, although many are blended from within the region. Let's have our second clue, and it should give it away to most of you guys. Our mystery region is located in the northeast edge of New Zealand's South Island and is centred around the towns of Blenheim and Renwick. It's the country's preeminent wine-producing region, boasting such names as Cloudy Bay, Hunters and Montana. Sauvignon Blanc is the mystery region's jewel in the crown, and the wines made here are known for their intense gooseberry grassy style. But other varieties to keep an eye out for are Riesling and Pinot Noirs. Right, that should give it away to most of you wine buffs. I'll give you the answer to the mystery region after our interview, which is coming up next. This week, we're talking with Peter Franz, the part owner and manager of Sensible Wine Services, one of the UK's most successful wine companies. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm here with Peter Franz from Sensible Wine Services. How are you, Peter?
I'm very good, thank you very much, Chris.
Sensible Wine Service, I always think of you like almost cogs of the wine industry, or maybe the oil that lubricates the wine industry. Is that...
That's a very nice way to put it, yes. But, you know, most of our business is behind the scenes, making things happen for shows, tastings around the UK and into Europe. We work for all the generic bodies, set up their massive tastings.
I mean, generic bodies, are they like the trade bodies for like
the trade bodies.
Wine growers of New Zealand? And
Wines of South Africa, France, Italy, just about anybody that does tastings, especially in the UK, we seem to get involved with.
Yeah, you seem to be pretty dominant. You're always at shows that I'm at.
I love the wine trade, I love the people, so I tend to go to just about all of the tastings, meet up with old friends and have a good old chat. So it's more of a social thing and get the team to actually do all the work.
How big a team have you got?
In total, there's 14 of us full-time, and then we sort of can call on about another 25, 30 people as and when we need them around the UK, because as well as doing predominantly the business in London, we do a bit abroad. We do an expo. We've just come back from a New Zealand tour in Stockholm and Hamburg. So we get around a little bit.
Sure, sure. And how does it work? We're at the wine show at the moment recording this. Mm. Do they come to you and say, look, Pete, I need you to help out? Or do the individual exhibitors come to you? Or is everybody coming to you?
It's just about everybody that comes to us. It's usually the organisers that will talk to us in the first place. And then we do sort of handle the logistics. Here at the wine show, we look after all the spittoons, the water, all the glasses are coming through from us,
there's
as well as handling. There's an awful lot of glasses here. I think we've brought in something like 40,000 glasses into the event. So it's a bit of both. And then the organisers will put individual companies. We also help run stands. We've got very knowledgeable staff that can run stands for them, talk about their wines as well. So it covers all aspects of the wine trade, really.
You must have, if you've got 40,000 glasses, you must have a lot of people polishing.
A few years ago, I did this major investment and looked into glass washers, and you'd be surprised how many different ones are on the market. But we managed to find one from a company called Hobart that actually takes all the minerals out of the water and just purifies the glass. So this unit cost me, I think, about £40,000. But you don't even need to polish the glass. It goes in one end and comes out the other. The beauty, and we always say to people, please don't wash the glasses before they come back to us, because if they do, they tend to put like a residual film over the top of the glasses, and then we have to wash them about three times. So we'd rather them come back dirty, go through this magnificent machine, and come out the other side all sparkling.
Okay, is it just ISO glasses you provide?
No, we also do Riedel, and we hold the UK rights to do hire out Riedel glasses. We've got about 15,000 different glasses, everything from on Rache to Champagne, to the predominant ones that people use are the Chianti all-purpose ones. We have a stock usually of about between 8,000 and 10,000 in stock, and most of those are out nearly every week, because as well as doing shows such as this, we also supply the major restaurants when they have larger functions in London as well. So, nice little business.
Excellent. Sounds pretty good. And is business good during the recession?
The funny thing is with the recession, everybody was talking about recession last year, and really strange, we were about 20% up on last year. But with things now biting this year, I think we'll probably be down about 10% in total, which overall state of affairs, I don't think that's a bad idea and such a bad thing. So we've just got to come out the other side and start growing again.
Sure. How did you get into the wine trade? Because you said you've been in it for a while. You've got a bit of snow on the bed.
Just a bit of the snow. I think I'm coming out going darker, coming out the other side and going the other way again now. I started in the wine trade, a little cellar boy in a place called Bedford. And it was just an advert that somebody seen. Amazingly, that's how I got into it. So I used to run this little cellar for this company called Dooley & Johnson, which is long gone nowadays. But in the cellar, there were some amazing wines that they used to supply down there. My first ever sort of bottle that I ever sort of recognised was Chateau de Chem 1961. And it just got into a fascination, and all the way through my life. I worked for Cash and Carry, then I worked for Augustus Barnett for nearly 20, 25 years. And 15 years ago, decided to jump and start this company up together with a business partner who used to be my boss, who's since now retired, Norman. And so it's just sort of grown from there, and people keep coming up to us and saying, can you do so-and-so? So sort of look at it, think about it, and the answer is usually yes, to the dismay of my staff. But things are really good, and, you know, tastings will always happen because it's the only way to sell wine. So hopefully, long-term, we'll still be around another 15 years' time when the next generation comes through.
You do a lot of work for the International Wine Challenge. I've noticed whenever, if you look at their website, they send the wines to you almost directly, don't they?
We do for Decanter World Wine Awards, more so than the International Wine Challenge. Decanter World Wine Awards this year, I believe, overtook the International Wine Challenge with over 10,000 entries. And being a year of so-called recession and everything else wasn't a bad achievement. Now, with that, all the wines come into our warehouse and you get 10,250 parcels. DHL queuing up at the door with thousands of parcels, which we have to then unpack, sort out into country, make sure there's no cheating going on and with the entry sheets, make sure that the vintages are correct. There's a lot of attention to detail to that. And then start putting them into flights after that. So for about 6 to 8 weeks, solid work with about 20 people in a warehouse, deciphering all these wines and then bagging them, make sure they can't, again, when they get the other end to be tasted, they don't know what they're tasting. That's quite an intense time.
Yeah, I see your guys everywhere. They got the SWS logo on. Mm-hmm. So if you see, I'm sure some of the listeners will have seen you out, maybe even some help you out.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Where do you get your stuff? Because obviously, we've actually used you guys a wee bit in some of our tastings just as support. In fact, you've even helped out.
I mean, the last one. Yes. Which is very good, actually. And amazingly, the venue that you use there, we're going to use for Washington and Oregon in January next year. So it works both ways. You help me by finding a venue.
Yeah. Where do you get your staff from?
A lot of the staff are people that I've known over the years. And this year, we just put another 4 people through the WSET and a couple are going on for the diploma. They tend to be keen enthusiasts. We also use a lot of people in the wine trade that have either in between jobs and one or two things. So there's always seems to be plenty of staff with wine knowledge around at the moment. So
the wine trade does have a lot of sort of freelance people, doesn't it?
It does. And also, everybody knows everybody else. It's such a friendly trade. I love being in the wine trade, and that's probably why I stuck with it all this time, because there's a lot of really, really nice people out there. Everybody from the growers that always invite us to come over and see us, to people who run the companies, to the girls in the offices. And it's just an amazing trade. And everybody wants to be in it.
That's true. I always think, though, probably the best way of making money is not to sell wine.
Exactly. We learnt that a long time ago. And one of the reasons I sort of set up this side of the company instead of moving on and buying a wine shop and whatever, because the competition is so fierce out there. People like Tesco, Sainsbury's have just about screwing everybody down, unfortunately. And, but I think people have got to start now with the recession coming out, recession, they've got to look about making money and not just sort of vast volumes and short things, because I think too many good companies have fallen down by the wayside in the last 2 or 3 years by going down that route.
When I looked at the wine trade about, oh God, what year was it? It was about 7 years ago, and we said, right, we're going to go into the wine business. We looked at it and we thought, we don't want to sell wine because that's going to be just, the capital cost is too high and it's just too risky, and we didn't really know what we were doing. And we looked at your business, or a logistics-style business, and we thought, oh, that's not bad, and that was a possibility. And I almost set up as a competitor to you at one point.
Yeah, I didn't know at the time, actually. Yeah, it's quite strange.
But do you have much competition? Because you seem to have everything sewn up.
No, there is some competition. A guy that used to work for me, he's set up on his own in a bit of competition, but that's the way of life, I suppose.
Yeah, you can't stop people from competing.
No. But, we seem to still, hopefully, the level of service that we provide for people, they're more than happy with, and 99% of them are stuck with us, so still quite happy with us, hopefully.
What's your favourite show? Because you do so many.
My favourite show is Vin Expo, because the strange thing is I go down there, do it myself, and get local staff, because I know quite a few people around Bordeaux, and then do 2 days' work beforehand, have 4 days off in between. And for some unknown reason, it's always the hottest time of the year. It's reached sort of 35, 40 degrees down
there. There's no air conditioning.
There's no air conditioning. Yeah.
Or usually, only in the New World stalls.
Well, there is nowadays because of all of the mess-ups that we had. But, you know, I sort of get 3 or 4 days in between to play a bit of golf and enjoy it, go and visit a few chateaus, and then break down the show afterwards. So, although it's a little bit of a holiday as well as a working experience. But there's so many good shows at the moment. The wine show here, which I believe is going to move around for next year into another capacity.
Yeah, it's been bought out by the BBC.
The BBC, and hopefully they'll retain it in its own right, because the quality of the people at the show. I was working on a stall last night for DeBortoli, and when you talk to the people, they're really enthusiastic, yeah. And you know, they want to try different wines, they want to try something different. So the quality of the customer, if they can retain that quality for the coming years, that is what they should be looking at, and trying to get people to express the different styles of wine, what it's all about, food matching like you do yourself, Chris, there. And, you know, get people more interested instead of the cheap end of the market and getting drunk and being abusive, etc.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, what would you... You must be getting close to retirement. I don't want to sound rude. Is that true?
Everybody I talked to sort of said, crikey, haven't you retired yet? But while I've still got the buzz and there's good people out there that I can sort of sit and have a chat with, like poor old Oz, who's looking a bit grey around the gills today. You know, I've known Oz a long time, and we get on great, and we have a little chat, talk about football and other things as well as the wine business. I'll still be carrying on, I'll still be doing it. But I've got a great team behind me. They are a really, really fantastic team that I've got. They do more and more of the work, and as they say to me, I do more and more of the chatting.
Yeah. So you're the head now, as opposed the figurehead,
figurehead. And I really, as I say, it's the people in the wine trade. I think there's some amazing characters out there, some lovely, lovely people. And as long as, you know, I'm able, I'll still be at the shows.
Okay, then. Well, thanks very much, Peter. I think we'll wrap it up there.
That's great.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks so much, Chris. All the best.
Cheers. Rightio, that pretty much ends this week's interview. Pete runs a very successful business and shows that you don't need to be selling wine to make money in the trade. In fact, that's probably an advantage. Next week, we're going to be talking with Lisa McGovern. Lisa heads up Wine Australia, and we talk to her about the challenges of her new role. I know Lisa quite well. She used to run wine tastings for us, so just a wee aside there. So we've got good staff. Another wee plug there. Sorry about that. But to finish up with, how did you get on with the mystery region? It was, of course, Marlborough. Here are the clues again. Marlborough is located on the northeastern edge of New Zealand's South Island and is centred around the towns of Blenheim and Renwick. It's the country's preeminent wine-producing region, boasting such names as Cloudy Bay, Hunters and Montana. Commercial winemaking began as early as 1875. However, the modern story really started in 1973, when Montana planted the new varieties such as Sauvignon Blanc, but a Miller Thurgau and also Cabernet Sauvignon. Marlborough soils are the result of 200 million years when glaciers carved out mountains and deposited stony soils on the Wairau River. Silty sand loam now covers the stony base, creating free-drained soils, which are perfect for growing grapes. Marlborough's sunny but not too excessively hot climate gives a long, low ripening period. The region's average daytime temperature of 24 degrees Celsius and a nighttime temperature difference of about 10 degrees Celsius helps to keep the acidity in the grapes. This gives the freshness to the wines are known for. Sauvignon Blanc is Marlborough's jewel in the crown, and the wine's best known for their intense, grassy, gooseberry style. But other varieties to keep an eye out for are Riesling and Pinot Noir, which is growing quite nicely there. Okay, that pretty much ends this week's show. One last thing is a quote, and this week's quote is a German proverb. Here it goes. Drink, die. Drink not, die anyway. Therefore, drink. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.